Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Good morning and good Monday to everyone listening here to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. I was torn today about what I wanted to talk about on the podcast. I had a full subject for the show. I wanted to talk about finally responding to a lot of the things that Dan Barker said in his closing statement in the debate that I had with him last September on the question, does the Christian God exist? And I'm still going to approach that. In fact, there's a large well of resources that Dan could have derived from his previous books and writings that I was chomping at the bit to be able to respond to in a live debate. Like, I had my notes, I had my rebuttals, I was ready to go, and it didn't happen. And I'll get into that more about why it didn't happen when I talk about the debate. And I'm still going to talk about the debate on the podcast today. But another story has brought itself to my attention that I just saw it last night before I was going to sleep. So I thought I would just go on social media to talk about, you know, air my views, what I thought about that. And then woke up this morning with all kinds of responses, you know, 90% of them positive. And then the few people jumping on board who are not so happy. But it's something that we are going to confront a lot more in the future. So we have to be prepared for it. So I'm going to start by talking about that. Then I'm going to circle back around to the debate. So have no fear. So what I want to talk about is this story coming out of Virginia at West Point. A high school teacher was fired. The board there unanimously voted to terminate Peter Flaming for his refusal to use masculine pronouns to describe a female student. Of course, this female student identifies as transgender. So this woman, this young girl, claims to be a boy and demands that other people use pronouns like he or him. And Flaming said he would not do that. Now, Flaming, to his credit, he, you know, I mean, people have, I agree with this tactic, if you will. I don't necessarily think everybody has to do that, but he tried to be as accommodating as he could. So he called this student by her new masculine name. So he called her, you know, by whatever this new masculine name is. He was fine with that. He used the new masculine name. People change their names all the time, and names, you know, they're stretchable, I guess. I mean, there are people who have kind of androgynous names. You know, you ever watch that old Saturday Night Live skit? It's Pat. You know, Pat could be Patrick, could be Patricia. There's Terry. There's Chris. Cameron. I know Camerons that are male and female. So, you know, there are names that are, some people have more feminine sounding names. Some women have more masculine sounding names. It's not that big a deal. But what Flaming refused to do was to use the incorrect pronouns to identify the student. So he just used her new name instead of he or him. This was not a case of a teacher using the correct pronouns. He didn't even do that. He didn't say her or she. He didn't do that. He was fired. You got to get this through your heads here. He was fired because of what he chose to not say. That the age of tolerance is over. It's not about tolerance anymore. Now it's get with the program, do exactly as we say, or else. And it's you know, George Orwell talked about this. This is Newspeak. That the idea of him not using certain language is now considered harassment. That it's harassment and discrimination to not say something. Whereas traditionally, harassment and discrimination, like, is when you used an ethnic slur, when you spoke or acted in a certain way to discriminate against someone in an unjust way. And that's not what's happening here. So I want to play a little bit of the news story. Now that you have the background, this includes clips of Flaming at the school board hearing, defending his job, and people there showing up in support of him. So this is from the Fox 8 local news coverage of this story.
And even higher than my family ranks my faith.
Like reading a sermon out of the good book.
I hope you perceive the absurdity of this.
This West Point High School French teacher fights to save his job.
We are here today because a specific worldview is being imposed upon me.
Okay, so first, I get maybe what he's trying to say. He's talking about how he doesn't want to violate his faith, so the newscaster says, just like a sermon from the good book. Maybe that's what he means. But there's also could be an ulterior motive saying, here's just a radical religious nutcase spouting about the Bible, when this is not a biblical issue. This is an issue of reality, of just, I should not be compelled to lie about reality when it comes to other people. I can be nice and kind to them. I can serve them. But you can't force me to lie about other people. I'm not going to break the Eighth Commandment and do that, even if it hurts your feelings. I'm sorry. Now, I'm not going to necessarily say a truth that maybe you're not ready to receive. I might refrain and just simply be silent at the moment. That's perfectly legitimate, yet it's not legitimate anymore. So let's listen on more.
The proceedings Thursday were a trial of sorts, absent of a courtroom, including a swearing-in of witnesses like the teacher in question, Peter Flaming.
And during this eight period in mid-October, I had four or five students in my classroom.
The school board says Flaming violated their non-discrimination and harassment policies when he refused to call a rising ninth grade transgender student who identifies as a male as he and him, telling the principal back in October.
I've had a slip up, and he went on to describe what had happened. He goes, the student was participating in an activity, almost walked into a wall, and I yelled out, stop her.
And by failing.
Well, that's what we call a Freudian slip in the sense of letting out truth inadvertently because you're desperately trying to suppress it for some reason. Now, many of us might have Freudian slips, or I mean, not Freudian, it's more of a subconscious slip. But sometimes, you know, out of politeness, we try not to say what's obvious, and yet it just still comes out in the heat of the moment. That's what we call a faux pas. It is not harassment or discrimination. Well, contrary to what other people say, as you'll hear.
Willing to follow the directive. He was therefore discriminating and therefore creating a hostile environment.
The teacher's lawyer argues that his client cannot be forced to say something that violates his conscience and his beliefs as a Christian. The public hearing started at 3, and 5 hours later,
all in favor.
Aye.
A unanimous decision. Flaming was let go.
The fact that I'm being asked to adopt a new ideology on who we are as humans.
I asked the sole provider of his wife and four young children, a teacher at West Point for nearly 7 years.
Was this worth it? Was this fight worth it?
There are some hills that are worth dying on.
Amen. Good for him. And this is something we have to take into account. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to use the word persecution. That's when you say, well, you're making a mountain out of a molehill. No, this is the same, you know, we may not be getting to that point yet, but there was a time in ancient Rome and also in, you know, feudal Japan. Well, it wouldn't be feudal Japan. Later on, you remember that book, Silence, that the similar thing happened in Japan and in ancient Rome where Christians are told, hey, you have to step on this image of Jesus or spit on this image of Jesus, or we're going to kill you and we're going to kill your friends. We're going to kill your family. We're not there yet, but there are people who courageously, you know, some people might say, what does it matter? You know, you're just putting your foot on Jesus. You're just putting saliva on him. Does it really matter so much? Yeah, it does. It does. Jesus said, he who denies me before men, I will deny him before my heavenly Father. That above all else, we have to stand for what is true. And as St. Peter said in Acts 5:29, we have to obey God rather than man. And this isn't just, as I said before, this is not just obeying sectarian principles. This is not just something that we can know by revelation. We can just know by reason, that people of reason can know this is unreasonable and they should not violate their conscience and take part in this. That's why you have people like Jordan Peterson up in Canada who said, you know, he was part of the Canadian school system up there and he's told you have to use these pronouns. And he said, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to be compelled. And they said, well, look, you're not going to go to jail. You might have to pay a fine. And Peterson said, what if I don't pay the fine? He said, I'm not going to pay the fine. And if they put me in jail, I'll go on a hunger strike. And so that's why I think he has surged in popularity because people are so glad to see even a relatively secular person. That Peterson has a lot of goodwill, I think, towards Christianity, though he has muddled thoughts about it. But someone who is relatively secular, willing to just stand up for the obvious truth and step out of this relativism that we're in. So I wrote on my Facebook page, I was talking about how it's ironic that the right to do what you want with your body, you have the right, I guess, to have an abortion, you have the right to, if you're a man, say you're a woman, you have the right to do all these things that you don't have the right with your own body to close your mouth and not say a pronoun you don't want to say. Point that out to people. If they have this right of personal autonomy, hostile work environment, why don't the rest of us have the right to not be in a hostile work environment where we're forced to say things we don't want to say? Now, quick rebuttal here. I mean, sometimes people can be compelled to speak in limited commercial environments. So, you know, a doctor has to tell you if a surgery has certain risks involved, which makes sense then in things like abortion, where doctors have said, you can't force me to say certain things. No, as a doctor, you have a medical responsibility to your patient to tell them the truth about the procedure. Can't lie to them. You can't hide morally relevant facts. So in some limited cases in commercial contexts, a person can be compelled to speak. But in general, people cannot be compelled to say things that violate their own beliefs. They just can't. And so that's something we should bring up, that if everyone has the right to all this personal autonomy, why don't I have the right to not say that which, and I would recommend for you when this comes up, not to say, right, what violates my faith, violates my principles, but just to say, I should have the right to not tell lies. I should have the right to not tell lies about other people, including a lie about whether they are a man or a woman. So I put this on Facebook, which I thought was very reasonable. Yet one commenter on here says that my remark was way off base. What does abortion have to do with this? Well, I just explained that. I think you can draw it out pretty easily. He says, secondly, and this person I believe also is Catholic, by the way. So his profile picture has him and the Pope in there. But you never know. But seems to be. And you'll find this, and I thought I'll probably do a show on this in the future, that you have a growing number of Catholics. I wrote a response to, this is for my bioethics homework. Maybe I'll repurpose it for a published article. I actually got an article published in the National Catholic Bioethics Center. They have the Bioethics Quarterly. They have a quarterly journal. I just got an article published with them on abortion. So I might do one on Catholics who defend transgender ideology. I responded to Beckett Gremmels has a piece. He's a Catholic ethicist who says that maybe transgender reconstruction surgery could be okay in limited context. I have a response to that. But the more and more, you're going to find Catholics who will say, well, God made transgender people, so maybe we have to just respect them and love them and support them. And that's what this guy was saying here on my Facebook page. I'll say, no, God allows people to bear various crosses, including identity disorders. Just because something happens doesn't mean God positively wills it and says that it's a good. So because we live in a sinful, fallen world, our bodies do not function. They're succumb to disease, to death, all kinds of maladies, including mental maladies like mental disorders. And we should be compassionate towards people who have a mental disorder. We shouldn't make fun of them or ostracize them. We should do our best to help them deal with the dysphoria that they have. But we should not enable or celebrate this particular disorder that they have. So this person wrote down, this wasn't one time. He was told repeatedly, I assume, not to do this. Well, just because someone's told to violate their conscience repeatedly doesn't mean they have to do that. And then he just goes on to say, I've grown up with people. This doesn't happen overnight. There's a lot of psychiatric work that happens before they prescribe and do operations. Yeah, people got identity disorders for a very long time. But once again, that doesn't mean that you facilitate them. So I asked him, and I haven't gotten a response yet. Maybe I'll get a response later. I'm not sure. I said at the end. I agree this is a difficult cross for someone to bear, but do you think we should just pretend a person who claims to be a race, sex, or species to which they don't belong, or he or she doesn't belong, does not have a disorder and needs to be treated? If love wills the good and a lie contradicts the good, then how can we love someone with gender dysphoria by lying to them about whether they are a man or a woman, or by giving them medical treatment that disfigures or mutilates their own body, as happens with teenagers who have gender dysphoria and are identified, diagnosed as being transgender? So, yeah, this one just stuck out to me, especially just seeing the responses from what I assume in some cases are faithful Catholics who have been caught up in this. So I would recommend, if you want more resources on this subject, you should go and check out Ryan Anderson's book. What's the book? When Harry Became Sally. When Harry Became Sally. So when Harry Met Sally, the movie, but When Harry Became Sally, response to the transgender movement. So that's all I want to say about that. I want to get on to the other subject about Dan Barker, my response to him in the debate, because now it's finally up on YouTube. But before I do that, I want to give a special shout out and thanks to our subscribers, to our premium subscribers on Patreon. You guys are awesome. You're keeping the show going and you get access to bonus material. We had a great little bonus excerpt from my audio version of my book, Why We're Catholic, which is available. You'll be coming out soon in the spring, but we have bonus chapters available to our premium subscribers at trendhornpodcast.com. Consider making a donation there to keep the podcast going at trendhornpodcast.com. Now, Next up, I wanted to talk about the debate with Barker. I mentioned this on the podcast a while back. I think I did a show like right after I did the debate when I got off the plane. I came down here, you know, here in San Diego and got in the studio and just talked about the debate, which I thought went very well. And now you can watch it on YouTube because for a long time it was stuck on the university's website. And oh man, it took us forever before that footage finally got sent to us. And I'm grateful it was sent to us and it was actually all edited. It was easy for us to put up on our Catholic Answers YouTube page. But the debate was back in September. For those of you who didn't hear it or don't remember, I debated Dan Barker. He is the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, not Freedom of Religion Foundation, the Freedom From Religion Foundation, as if religion is this terrible, awful thing that built hospitals and soup kitchens and orphanages and leads to greater life expectancy for people who are regular churchgoers and devout believers, as is shown in sociological studies. Oh, we got to get away from that scary stuff. So we debated the question, does the Christian God exist? Because last time Dan and I debated, that was here in San Diego in 2014. No, it's 2013. 2014. It was 2014. I had just finished writing Answering Atheism. And we debated the question, does God exist, or God, supreme being, or imaginary friend? So we decided to narrow it down a little bit. Does the Christian God exist? And because of that, I had three or four arguments for the existence of God, the God of classical theism, all-knowing, all-powerful, infinite, necessary, all-good God. But then people say, well, which God? How do you know it's the Christian God? That is why I took a significant amount of time in my opening statement to present a defense, a historical defense of Christ's resurrection from the dead. Because for me, that really cuts through the fog. A lot of people say, well, how do you know which God it is? I'll say, well, look, if Jesus did not rise from the dead, then that takes Christianity off the table because Jesus was a fraud at that point, if he did not rise from the dead. So Christianity is off the table. We could look at Islam, Judaism, Hinduism. We'll start looking at other religions. But guess what? If Jesus Christ did rise from the dead, I know all these other religions cannot be the true religion. Their God cannot be the true God because Jesus demonstrated that he is God by raising himself from the dead and vindicating his claims to divinity. So I put forward these arguments, and I had read Dan's book, Godless. I'd watched previous debates that he'd done to see how he's done entire debates on the resurrection. I think he actually did a whole radio debate with William Albrecht, who is a Catholic apologist, and I thought Albrecht did a stupendous job actually debating Dan on that issue, just right there in that debate. And he's also debated Mike Lacona, the evangelical apologist, other people. I think he debated my friend Justin Bass, who is an evangelical, young evangelical guy who's an apologist, does a lot of great work. So I watched and prepared because that's what I do for debates. And though debates favor the prepared. And I was ready, and I brought up my evidence of the resurrection, and I was waiting for Dan to, what I'm going to play for you, were his objections to it. I really wanted to get those objections so I could fire back and say, hey, here's where these objections fall through. But I didn't get a chance to do that because Dan saved his objections for the closing statement. And because he was the negative, the person arguing against the saying no to the question in the debate, he gets to speak last. The affirmative gets to speak first, set the tone. There's an advantage there. Negative has an advantage too because they get to speak last. They're the last word. And so Dan saved his rebuttals there. And so what am I going to do? I just got to sit there with a smile on my face like, well, I'll respond to this at some point, which I really would have enjoyed doing in the midst of our debate, preferably in cross-examination. So let's just go through a little bit of what Dan said in his closing, and I might grab a few tidbits from his books and respond to that as well.
Women were always at the tombs in the ancient Middle East, in the Near East. Women were entrusted with taking care of the tombs. Women were there to bring the spices. Women were expected to be at the tombs. And women were listened to. Women were judges. Women were revered in much of the Bible. So the fact that women appear in the resurrection story doesn't make it somehow scandalously special.
Dan is referring to my argument that the empty tomb story is historical because if you were to fabricate this story, you would try to make it as believable as possible. And so only including female witnesses to the empty tomb makes it less plausible to people. Why would you include such an embarrassing detail? Be today if I tried to tell a story about someone rising from the dead and my witnesses who discovered this fact were kindergartners. That's such a strange detail. It makes it not very credible. You'd only report it if that is what really happened. But the problem with Dan's argument, though, is that when we look at other apocryphal gospels, for example, like the Gospel of Peter, there you have when people actually embellish the story and flat out make it up. You have there the empty tomb is discovered by the Jewish priests, the Roman soldiers, other male witnesses are there, and then they see Jesus himself come out of the tomb, and he goes up in the sky, and he's like 500 feet tall. And then the cross comes out, and the actual cross comes out and starts talking. Though I actually was reading an article the other night from Mark Goodacre, who is a New Testament scholar, does great work on the subject of Q. We'll have to talk about that in a future episode. It's a New Testament jargon about sources for the New Testament. He says that there might be a translation error where it's not the cross that's talking, but the crucified one. Interesting detail, but, you know, I'm always reading odd articles at night to stay abreast with theology and developments, New Testament studies, things like that. The point is, when you look at these made-up stories, they include male witnesses, and even Richard Bauckham did an article on the women at the tomb. He's a great New Testament scholar, saying that the Gospel of Peter includes the women at the tomb, even though they're not necessary for the story, because the male witnesses already corroborate it. He includes Gospel of Peter, written in 2nd century, obviously not by Peter, it was written over a century after he died, that the female witnesses to the tomb are kept in that apocryphal Gospel of Peter because it was such an integral part of the story. You just had to include it because everyone knew that is what happened. That in the ancient world, you couldn't trust the testimony of women. In the early church, this was something that people attacked Christians about. The ecclesial writer Origen wrote a work called Contra Celsum, or Celsum, like Celsius. So it'd be Celsum. Contra Celsus. Celsus was a pagan critic of the church. Origen wrote a response to him and quotes Celsus's attacks. And Celsus says, "You said he rose from the dead, but who told you this? A hysterical woman." So this is still plaguing us. And now Barker says, well, you would expect women to be there because they anoint the bodies, things like that. Yeah, but in the accounts, the women say, who will roll away a stone for us? Oh, I don't know. Maybe somebody will be there. Why wouldn't you include the women and men and say, and then the women went to the tomb and brought Peter and John with them to roll away the stone? If you were making it up, you could include other corroborating male witnesses. Why just female witnesses? It leaves you in an embarrassing lurch unless that is what really happened.
It would be surprising if there were not women at the tomb. And by the way, the contradictions in the resurrection accounts are not trivial. If the four different accounts give different women who came to the tomb.
It lists different ones, but it doesn't say only. Like in John, it says Mary Magdalene went, but it doesn't say only Mary Magdalene went. The accounts all agree that it was Mary Magdalene and a group of other women. They agree on that, even if they don't name all of them.
Different times. And at one time...
Now, they don't go at different times, Dan. It says they all agree it was early in the morning when it was dark or sunrise. People didn't have their Timex watches on them in the New Testament world. It was around sunrise. That's enough. That is enough of an approximation. It's not like one said they went at sunrise and the other group went at sunset. That would be a very clear contradiction. They all agree it was early in the morning.
In three times when the women got to the tomb, it was open. But in Matthew, when the women got to the tomb, it was closed, and then the angel came, and there was an earthquake, and it opened in their presence. These are not trivial differences, and even if they are small differences.
Actually, here's what Matthew says in Matthew chapter 28. It says, after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the sepulcher. Note it doesn't say only those two women. It says there here were two that went to the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat upon it. But here, verse 2 in Matthew 28 isn't necessarily talking about what happened after the women got there. It's just saying, hey, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to the tomb. But guess what? There was a great earthquake, and a stone was rolled away, and the guards who were there, they fled. But the angel said to the women, it doesn't assume here that all this happened in the presence of the women. This could have happened either in their presence and other women came there, or they arrived after these events involving the angel and the guards that fled the tomb. So let's continue on.
Differences in the big picture, they do show that at least some of the elements in the storytelling lack some credibility. In a court of law, it would question the credibility of the witnesses to say, well, you're getting too many facts wrong here. When Paul says that Jesus...
Getting too many facts wrong, there are minor discrepancies, changes in variant details, secondary details, which is normal when people tell stories. In fact, if they were all carbon copies of one another, you would say that doesn't work, that they're all copying a single source. So it's kind of a heads I win, tails you lose. They all agree. I would have asked Dan in cross-examination, what do they all agree on, though? They agree that Jesus Christ rose from the dead, that his tomb was empty and he's no longer there. That is a very big thing that they all agree on.
Appeared to Peter and to the 500. That word appeared is a curious word. If I went to your house and you opened the door and I said, oh, I went to Trent's house and Trent appeared unto me, you would think I was talking about a haunted house, right? Or a ghost or something. That's in all of the Gospels, before that point, people met people, they saw people, they were with people, they traveled. But after the resurrection, it switches to that Greek participle, ophthi, which is where we get the word vision from, basically. It was an appearance, and yet he appeared to these people, and he appeared to them. It was kind of like a spooky vanishing act kind of thing. That's not what you would expect of a resurrected body.
Okay, so what Dan is saying here is that Jesus did not physically rise from the dead, but that the apostles hallucinated and believed that Jesus had a spiritual resurrection, that his spirit went into heaven, and so the ghost of Jesus, or his spirit then, appeared to people after the resurrection while his body lie decomposing in the tomb. And so Paul uses the word opthē, which is the participle, I think it's past participle, of orao, which means to see. It's the word for physical sight. It can also be used for visions, but here, just because a word can be used for a vision doesn't mean that it always means that. So there's a few problems with what Barker's saying. Number one, I can use the word appeared to mean something that's not a haunted house, or a spooky vision or materialization out of thin air. I might say to my wife, hey, are you going to make an appearance at our party tonight? You know, oh, I might appear there, you know, later. That's a normal thing that people say, that to say that something appeared to me. Oh, it appears to me. You can mean that analogously. It appears that you mean this, that you can see something in an analogous way, or that it appeared right in front of me. I saw it with my own eyes. So that doesn't cut against it at all. Also, here's another problem with what Dan is arguing. And this is what I would have asked him in cross-examination if I had gotten the chance. I would have asked Dan, where does the New Testament use the word opthi, which means appeared, to describe a subjective vision when the word for vision or orama is absent? The answer is that never happens in the New Testament. That when a person has a vision, the word, and that word opthi is there, that this person appeared to them, then you see the word orama or vision. For example, in the book of Acts, Paul has a vision of a man from Macedonia speaking to him. And Luke specifically tells us that Paul had a vision in the night, an orama in the night. It was night in Greek, I think. Nukte, light is lux, like nocturnal. I think it's nukte. But in any case, Luke says he had a vision in the night. He had a dream that the man from Macedonia appeared to him. Yet in these resurrection accounts, you see that the word opthi is just talking about regular appearances. It doesn't always mean just a spiritual appearance. For example, in Luke chapter 24, when Luke is talking about these appearances, Luke describes the disciples saying, in Luke 24, it says, the Lord has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon. So Luke uses opthi to say that Jesus appeared to Simon in Luke 24. But he clearly doesn't mean a spiritual vision, because later he goes on in Luke 24:39 that when Jesus appears to Peter and the other apostles, Jesus says, see my hands and my feet, that it is I myself, handle me and see, for a spirit has not flesh and bones, as you see that I have. So here, that cuts right against the argument that Dan was making there, that, oh, well, opthi just means appearance, that in the New Testament, when it's talking about a visionary experience, the word opthi is always accompanied by the Greek word orama, to say that in a vision, so-and-so appeared to me. But you can also just appear to someone as a regular physical reality. And I'll include more of that, you know, maybe if you're nice, maybe if you're kind to me. I will go into this a little more detail on Workshop Wednesday this week, because I'm also working on my chapter for my book, Counterfeit Christ. Very excited about this in Counterfeit Christ, because in Why We're Catholic, I include a chapter on why we believe in the resurrection. And then in Counterfeit Christ, I have a chapter. I didn't want to just redo the resurrection stuff, because I already covered that. I'm going to include my resurrection material from Why We're Catholic as an appendix of the book. you know, that way it's helpful for people because you may not have heard that evidence before. So I'll include the resurrection evidence at the very end of Counterfeit Christ. But in the earlier chapters on how atheists view that, I'm going to respond to their objections, including Barker's objections to that evidence of the resurrection, including this claim that the apostles were only talking about a spiritual resurrection. So maybe we'll go into that more detail because I'm writing about that and other great stuff in Counterfeit Christ. Would love to share with you when you sit in with me at Workshop Wednesday. You all have been great. I'm very grateful for the support everyone's been giving. So do consider continuing to support the podcast. Go check out trendhornpodcast.com. Get more access to bonus materials there. You guys are awesome, and I hope you have a blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.